Welcome to CU Anschutz 360, a podcast about the CU Anschutz Medical Campus. We feature the interesting and innovative work of our faculty, staff, and students. I'm Kelsey Peters, Media Relations Professional in the Office of Communications. Today I'm speaking with Moksha Patel and Rachel Davis, both with CU School of Medicine. Moksha is a senior instructor of hospital medicine who came to CU Anschutz as a fellow. Rachel is an assistant professor of psychiatry and medical director of the Obsessive Compulsive Disorder program here. She researches and advocates for patients pursuing deep brain stimulation for OCD, a rare invasive brain surgery where electrodes are implanted in the deeper structures of the brain. These electrodes are then connected to generators in the chest that deliver small currents of electricity to the brain, similar to cardiac pacemakers. One of the patients she's helped is Moksha, a smart and successful physician who's dealt with obsessions and compulsions since childhood. In this episode, we'll hear about their experience, what Moksha has dealt with his whole life, how he got to the point of pursuing deep brain stimulation, what he encountered, how exposure therapy works, and how he's recovering. So Moksha, I'd like to get into your story. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, about your academic career, and how you've lived with OCD your whole life?
Yeah, so I'll kind of take that in two questions, but academic career, funnily enough, is greatly influenced by OCD as well. I went to undergraduate at UC Davis in California, went in undeclared, but at that time was struggling with severe obsessive compulsive disorder. And because of my personal history with the illness, I ended up becoming a psychology major. Through one step, through luck to another, and lo and behold, I ended up in medical school at Northwestern in Chicago, and then thought I was going to go into psychiatry. But during clinical rotations, I actually ended up loving internal medicine more and went down that route and came to CU for internal medicine residency about 5 years ago. Finished that a couple years ago, and then I did a fellowship in hospital medicine. And after that, I've been in my current role as a senior instructor for the Division of Hospital Medicine. So that's kind of my academic journey. Mm-hmm. The OCD and dealing with that my whole life, I can, you know, thinking back, no one in my family knew what OCD was. Mm-hmm. And I've had symptoms as early as probably 4 or 5 years old. I would say the first symptoms were probably reassurance seeking, asking a lot of questions, asking for lots of permission for things that were most people wouldn't ask permission for, including kids. Things like, oh, can I drink water? Can I, you know, use the bathroom? Things like that. And since then, it's really taken over a large part of my life. OCD has affected the way I bathe, use the bathroom, interact with friends, interact with family, interact with romantic partners, the way I work, my physical health, when I drive, I study, I sleep. All aspects of my life have really been, at least in some part, impacted by OCD. And in preparing for this, I asked my parents a little bit about what they saw as the impact and some of my close friends. And they said, one of the things they noticed is that even as a young kid, I could never be a kid. Mm. My dad said, you could never live in the moment. I could always see there was a disconnect between your mind and your body, mm-hmm. And your soul. And there was, your mind was always preoccupied with something else. Whether it was someone walking too close to me or whether I needed to wash my hands or along those lines. And, you know, on a more practical impact, it's affected my college choice. I was accepted to University of California, Berkeley, and that was my first choice. But being unable to leave home and live in the dormitories, I basically ended up having to stay at home and commute mm-hmm. for UC Davis, which in hindsight was a great choice for me, and I loved Davis. Mm-hmm. But college, and then in talking to my best friend from home, she mentioned that even in college, that the fact that I couldn't use the restrooms was a big barrier for socializing mm-hmm. and having to go to class, go back home, and then come back for an evening class often made things difficult. So, and then the other big thing is just traveling. You know, I haven't been able to visit my grandmother in England in years. Haven't been able to make many weddings. Field trips were difficult. So Lots of practical impacts in addition to the just daily burden that OCD has had on my life.
Right. You tell us a little bit about some of the ways that you tried to mitigate OCD throughout your life.
Yeah, excellent question. I think we really started recognizing it as a problem late middle school, early high school. And funnily enough, if anyone's familiar with the television show Monk, mm-hmm. About an OCD detective, that's kind of where we're like, hey, that guy is doing a lot of the stuff you're doing. And so we reached out to my pediatrician, and then she got me plugged in with healthcare. So I've been plugged in with mental health services since about 2007. And I've probably seen more than 13 professionals across three cities, psychologists, social workers, psychiatrists. And I've done a variety of different therapies, definitely done the gold standard exposure response prevention that Rachel mentioned, multiple sessions. At other times, we've also tried things like psychodynamic approach, which I was not very successful for me, cognitive behavioral therapy for other aspects of my mental health, and then group therapy as well. And then multiple medications. I think I've tried 7 to 8 different classes of medications to try to control my OCD. So really being plugged in with the mental health care system. And then outside of that, I think I've tried in the past, I went on a yoga retreat to Esalen Institute in Big Sur. Mm-hmm. That was a great break. I don't know if it was the yoga. The yoga was probably great, but honestly, just being on the ocean, it's a beautiful place. Mm-hmm. And so that was just amazing. Mm-hmm. So that definitely. And the third thing that I'll add, it's one of those catch-22s kind of things, because a lot of people often tell me, do you think your job and the stress that comes with being a physician exacerbates your OCD?
Right.
And I would argue, yes, there's a lot of stress that comes with being a physician. But in ways, it has actually been protective for me. You know, when I'm at work, I'm able to get out of my headspace and say, I need to focus on my patients. Mm-hmm. The structure, especially that residency brought, where you're working 6 days a week, 80 hours a week, constantly 4 days off a month, days, nights, everything, 24, 28 hour calls. That structure, I think, while it was hard, and I cannot stress how hard it was, I definitely think that structure was a way for me to keep my OCD in check.
Right, that makes sense. As a highly productive person, you need something to take you out of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
So I'll say, I'm really glad you said that, because a lot of people with OCD will think, man, if I can just find a different job, something less stressful, change my life, my OCD is going to be better. And that is rarely, rarely the case. So, you know, the problem is the brain. The problem isn't the surroundings. And your brain will take your surroundings and make it into an obsession, and regardless of how stressful the job would be otherwise. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really, really glad you highlighted that.
Mm-hmm. So what led to your decision to pursue DBS?
Yeah, so I think two things. And if it's okay with you, Kelsey, I'd like to read something that I wrote in, I think, 2007, actually.
Absolutely, yeah.
And this is, I was journaling, and I was going through my journals a couple days ago, and I wrote this sometime in high school. And there are few fates worse than that of being imprisoned within the untouchable and thus impenetrable walls of the mind's penitentiary of uncertainty, doubt, and irrationality. Day after day, you sit in this mental cell, abiding by the strict rituals and rules set by the subconscious part of your mind. Failure to comply, obey the commands, or compulsions of the correctional officers results in heavy punishments, such as solitary confinement, and the galling anxiety that comes with it. Yet these sufferings are insignificant compared with the prison's ghastly effect on our morale, with its cruel tendency to drain us of our innermost motivation, determination, and perseverance. Before long, you become hollow, unlively, and weak. Even the desire to escape is too much to bear. Gradually, the desire to enjoy, play, read, interact, learn, accomplish, in short, the desire to live itself begins to seep from you. This becomes your life, your prison, your home. And I think that quote really captured why I went for DBS.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
I felt stuck in my mind. And I tried the exposure, and I tried the medications, and I tried to do everything, but I didn't feel like I was making progress. And we can talk a little bit more about how Rachel and I met, but when we first met, she mentioned it briefly on one of our first meetings, and as we got to know each other more, I think it became more clear that I was definitely a candidate for this surgery, having failed more of the conventional treatments, and just feeling imprisoned all the time and having no true hope at that time of escape is what led me to pursue the DBS.
Right. And you wrote that in 2007. You were in high school?
Sometime in high school, yeah.
Okay. Okay, so Rachel, can you talk about how you guys met and how you began talking about this procedure?
Sure. So one of my roles is medical director of student and resident mental health here on this campus. And I believe, Moksha, your program director had referred you, right? Mm-hmm. He noticed you were struggling and referred you to student mental health. When I first met Moksha, the very first time, it wasn't clear to me quite how severe his symptoms were. I think, Moksha, I think you kind of downplayed them a little bit, probably in a desire to appear well. But as I got to know Moksha, it became pretty quickly clear to me how severe his symptoms were and how, while very functional in his role as a physician and very successful in that role, how disabled he was in other aspects of his life. And so I realized that Moksha spent much of his time when he was home either sleeping or doing rituals, or sleeping to avoid doing rituals, had very limited social interactions, and had actually not much of a life outside of medicine.
The way that my program, who was very supportive during residency, noticed that I was having these symptoms was, we would have noon conference every day pre-pandemic, and there would be food there. And I would never eat the food. And so my chief resident one day asked me, like, oh, hey, I noticed you don't eat at noon conference. Like, is the food not good? Is there something we need to do? And I mentioned to her that, oh, I don't use public restrooms because I have OCD. So in order to avoid having to use the restroom, I avoid trying to eat or drink at work. Mm-hmm. And so that is how my program and the chief resident kind of notified my program director, and they were like, you're doing great, but like, this isn't sustainable. Mm-hmm. You know, you're working really long hours. How can we help you be more functional at work? And so that's how they got me in touch with Rachel.
Yeah, and I want to point out, one of the interesting things about OCD is that if OCD is well managed, people with OCD often have traits that contribute to being a highly successful physician. So people with OCD are often very conscientious, they're very empathetic, they're very careful. When out of control, those traits can lead to working insanely long hours. Moksha, I've never had any concern about Moksha's ability to care for patients. If anything, he was too thorough and too careful. Right. It was more his own mental health that was of concern because of how careful and how thorough he was. You know, I can't imagine working 24, 30-hour shifts without drinking and without eating. I mean, that just had to be torture.
Right.
Yeah, it was not fun.
And the phrase, the term OCD is almost a substitute for perfectionism now. People
right.
use it flippantly and just say, oh, I'm OCD about that.
Right,
so.
Right.
Can you tell us about the process of initiating DBS, the procedure, and the hurdles you encountered? That's kind of a big question, so if you want to start with the process.
So given that DBS involves brain surgery, we have a very extensive screening and evaluation process. And so the first step is making sure that someone has tried all the standard of care treatments. So we review records, we get a thorough history, we make sure that they've tried at least 3 medications that act on serotonin for at least 12 weeks each at FDA max dose or higher. One of those has to be clomipramine, which is an older antidepressant. We make sure that they have tried an antipsychotic, that they have tried a benzodiazepine. We make sure that they've had at least 20 sessions of exposure and response prevention with a therapist who specializes in OCD. We make sure there's not an active substance use disorder, no ongoing or current psychosis, no concern for mania or bipolar disorder, no severe personality disorder. Basically, we need to know that someone will be able to tolerate this extensive process and have a chance of doing well at it. We also don't want someone who is acutely suicidal or who's had a suicide attempt in the last 6 months, because there is no guarantee that deep brain stimulation will work. It has about probably a 60% chance of someone having a response. But if someone is suicidal and they're viewing that really as their only hope, that is a devastating place to be. And so we're very, very careful about that. Now, I will say a lot of people with OCD have kind of thoughts that maybe I would be better if I died, mm-hmm. what we would call passive suicidal thoughts. And that isn't necessarily a contraindication, as long as they're determined not to act on those thoughts and they are able to plan for the future and plan for safety. Mm-hmm. So once we determine that someone meets all those criteria, then we move forward with the screening process. And so I referred Moksha to neuropsychological testing just to get a baseline, make sure there's no cognitive concerns. We do an MRI. We do what's called a SCID, which is a standardized clinical interview. After all those procedures are done, we have an ethics committee that meets. And on the ethics committee, we have neurosurgery, we have neuropsychology, we have neurology, and psychiatry. And, we discuss whether it is medically appropriate to proceed, and we also discuss whether it is ethically appropriate. We look at whether our patients have the appropriate social support, whether they have realistic expectations, mm-hmm. whether they have the ability to tolerate the process, among other things. And so, if we don't have a consensus, sometimes we might say, we have this concern. We really need to work on increasing social support before moving forward, and then we'll come back and review again. And so mm-hmm. once the ethics committee agrees that it makes sense to proceed, then the patient meets with neurosurgery. At that point is when we start to try to get the insurance authorization. And this is where we often run into difficulty. And so in Moksha's case, it took us, it was probably more than a year, right?
About a year.
Or about a year of appealing and appealing and appealing and starting the appeal process over. But that was about a year long of getting insurance approval.
On top of everything else, the tests and the thresholds that you had to meet, can you talk a little bit about this process for you?
Yeah. So Dr. Davis did a really good job of explaining it logistically. I will say, as a patient who is clearly struggling at that point and looking for hope, it was a rough year, mm-hmm. Over a year, because with everything else. And I think you just have to remember that it is a marathon, not a sprint. Mm-hmm. The SCID is like 4 or 5 hours. The neurocognitive testing takes multiple hours. We ended up having to do 2 MRIs, meeting with neurosurgery. All of that, was kind of paced, and we're like, okay, I have a plan, I know what it is. And then the insurance piece comes into play, and there's just a lot of unknown. And on top of what is already the stressors from a severe disease that is uncontrolled, you now add on this added layer to it, and it is rough. Mm-hmm. And I would just say that the only way I really was able to get through it is because Dr. Davis and her team were really, really great advocates for patients. Mm-hmm. And, I see this with a lot of my colleagues all the time, and where someone goes above and beyond and tries to help a patient who's uninsured or whatever. But I think that her persistence was really what ultimately helped us get through this journey. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So can you talk a bit about the insurance issues and how you went through that process?
Most private insurers have medical policies that deem DBS for OCD not medically necessary, whereas they deem DBS for Parkinson's medically necessary or DBS for dystonia medically necessary. And so, we went through the appeal process, and it was denied all the way up to the external review. And so people here on campus were very helpful in advocating for Moksha and helping to ultimately get this covered. And so what I ended up doing was I gathered a group of colleagues from across the nation, experts in DBS for psychiatric disorders or neurosurgery for psychiatric disorders. The group consisted of neurosurgeons, psychiatrists, psychologists, a neuroethicist, and 2 attorneys. And we wrote a manuscript which was published in Frontiers. Mm-hmm. And then we used that manuscript in a second round of appeals, which Moksha initiated. And this time, appeal was upheld and the denial was overturned. at the, it was the external review.
Right? It was the second level
of appeal.
Yeah.
Oh, the other thing we did is we insisted that Moksha be able to be present for a panel, which mm-hmm. we did over the phone. With all that background and the manuscript, they overturned the denial.
Mm-hmm. So, on to the procedure itself. Can you tell us about it and, you know, what you did to prep and how it went?
Yeah, what I did to prep, not a whole lot. I did all the, I went to the appointments, I did the cleaning and everything. It was weird. So for me, my family had to really be convinced.
Mm-hmm.
And there's different layers to my family. I have a very involved and extended family. And certain people were easier to convince than others. But I think my parents, my mom especially, was very nervous with this procedure. And so part of the battle was just getting everyone on board.
Mm-hmm.
And so what really helped with that was when they were able to meet and talk with both Dr. Davis and Dr. Ogeman, who was the neurosurgeon who performed my surgery. And especially on my appointment, my pre-op appointment with Dr. Ogeman, when my mom was finally able to talk to Dr. Ogeman, who would be doing the procedure, and he kind of laid it out very straightforward, and he was honest. He's like, listen, if this was my brother, I would recommend it.
Mm-hmm.
And she afterwards, she's like, okay, after talking to him, listening to the risks and stuff, A, I trust him, and B, I think he is very qualified and will do what's best for you.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the first part, is just getting everybody on board, and luckily we got there. And then I was very lucky to have support from both my job, who cleared up my schedule for about 2 months, I think,
mm-hmm.
a little bit pre-surgery for the appointments and then post-surgery for the recovery. And then my family, who visited, my mom, my sister, who's been my biggest supporter and best friend throughout all of this for years,
mm-hmm.
and my dad, my cousin, all who came and visited me during the post-op period. And so that was, I had amazing support. And then the procedure, how did it go? UC Health takes good care of their patients. You know, I'm biased. I work here. But the nurses were amazing. The physicians were amazing. The PAs were amazing. Everyone was just amazing. You know, I felt really well taken care of. They were, answered all my questions, you know, met all my needs.
Mm-hmm.
Post-surgery, especially after the, it's a two-part procedure. The first surgery is the kind of big one, which took about 10 hours in my case, is where they put the electrodes into the brain. And so 10 hours of general anesthesia can be a little hard on the body.
Mm-hmm.
And so post-surgery, I had a lot of nausea, no appetite for about a week, intractable hiccups. I remember one night I texted Dr. Davis. It was like 9 p.m. And I was like, I can't stop hiccuping. And she like ordered a medication. And my parents, like my dad and my cousin, drove down here and my sister to pick up something in like 10 p.m. And then the hiccups stopped when the medicine got there. So, the first couple weeks were pretty brutal. But I will say that one of the things that was nice is, and Dr. Davis can maybe clarify, but I think it's called a microsatellite lesion, where you have a little bit of benefit initially.
The microlesion effect.
The microlesion effect, yeah. And so I was really worried because at that point I was not using any public bathrooms.
Mm-hmm.
And in the post-surgical state, I wasn't confident that I was going to be able to do my normal hour-long ritual of bathing after using the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
But immediately after the surgery, for a little while, often patients will have a little bit of benefit even before the stimulator is on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the thought is that the procedure itself may cause a little bit of hemorrhage and in the part of the brain, and that actually can cause a temporary benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so that benefit actually was really helpful in those first few days. Where I wasn't able to do many of my rituals. So lots of hiccups, lots of nausea, no eating, but luckily was able to, OCD was temporarily better, and then kind of went back to being its baseline, but that was more like 5-6 days out.
Mm-hmm.
And by then I was able to get back on my feet and go back to doing my rituals until the stimulation started, in which case the world really started to change.
And I'll just jump in here for a minute and say, yeah, the microlesion effect is something they also see in Parkinson's disease, mm-hmm. Where they see some benefit before stimulation is turned on. And it's thought, I mean, we don't really know why it happens, but it's thought maybe to be related to inflammation mm-hmm. or just some minor tissue destruction in the area where the electrodes are.
That's fascinating. And I do want to clarify, you've told me that there are two types of this surgery, awake and asleep.
Right, right. So Moksha had a sleep surgery, so it was done under general anesthesia in an MRI. And so basically the neurosurgeon puts in the electrodes, checks it with an MRI, looks at location, adjusts the electrodes, looks at it with an MRI, checks the location, adjusts the electrodes. So that's one way of doing it. And then some surgeons prefer to do awake surgery, and that's just done under local anesthesia. It's possible because brain doesn't have nerve endings. Mm-hmm. And the reason for doing it awake is you can check for what's called physiological markers to support that your electrode is in the right location. And so if someone is having awake surgery, we'll turn on stimulation during the surgery, and what we hope to see is improved mood, decreased anxiety, and improved energy. And sometimes we'll even do exposures during surgery to see if people are better able to tolerate triggers or exposures than they would have been when stimulation is not turned on.
Right. Your surgery was about 7 months ago now. Can you reflect on how your life is different and what progress you've made and how you've kind of worked with everything?
Yeah, so the post-surgery, there's a large, as Dr. Davis mentioned earlier, programming component to it. And that can take many, many sessions to try to find a setting that is ideal. But we actually found pretty good settings early on. I think my second or third session, I was in a pretty good spot. And the way I describe it, before kind of talking about more actual accomplishments, is the obsessions are still there. Mm-hmm. They might be a little bit less frequent, but I don't think they're actually that much less frequent. They're still pretty frequent. I think, as I talked about earlier, you know, the obsessions cause distress. And this is where I think the DBS has really helped. That how loud those obsessions are, how annoying they are, how intrusive they are, that has gone down mm-hmm. and has gone down significantly. And so now, before, where I may have a thought that, oh, I just touched the door handle of a public restroom and I am contaminated, it would completely take over my brain. Mm-hmm. And I would have to either run and wash my hands or sanitize my hands or call my sister and ask for reassurance or, you know, a number of different rituals based off of where I was. Now, that thought would still come in my mind. Oh, you know, you touched the handle of a public restroom, you're contaminated. But it's a little bit quieter. And so now the inner me can say, yeah, you're contaminated, but we're going to sit with it. You know, we're going to, yeah, I don't feel great. I don't like the feeling, but I can handle it. And so what DBS did is gave me the ammunition and the equipment to be able to do the exposure therapy, which is vital mm-hmm. to beat OCD.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like it really gave you the space to make a choice.
That's a really great way of putting it. It gave me that mental space to now make a choice, because before I was reflexively acting.
Right.
And just from a logistical standpoint, some of the things that I've been able to do pre-surgery, I was usually showering after using the restroom. I no longer have to do that. I can use the restroom as most normal people do. I can use public restrooms now. I am able to better cope with outside, quote-unquote, germs. So previously, if I went shopping, bring everything in, sanitize everything. Mm-hmm. No longer feel the need to do that anymore. The number of reassurance questions I'm asking my family has gone down significantly. I'd say 60 to 80%, and on a good week, like 95%. Less confessions, less cleaning rituals. Just overall, have really made a lot of progress in a short amount of time, and really honestly hope to make a lot more.
And I think it's important to point out that you're still engaged in weekly exposure and response prevention, right? Like, it's not like you have the procedure and we're done. There's still a lot of work to be done. And so that's one thing I require of all my patients who have this process or this procedure, is that they continue in exposure and response therapy so that they can really, you know, make the most of the changes in their brain.
Can you talk a little bit about what an exposure and response therapy session looks like?
Sure. Moksha, is it okay if I talk about one of our exposure and response sessions?
Sounds great.
So we've been hanging out in the bathroom, unisex bathroom, and we've been inching closer and closer to the toilet, and Moksha's now at the point where he can touch the toilet with bare hands and then contaminate his clothes, his hair, his head, his face. You know, it's still not something that he enjoys, and it's not easy for him, but prior to DBS, there's no way that would have happened.
Yeah.
You know, the interesting thing is we also have a new sort of system that can sense brain, called local field potentials, but basically brain waves, and we've been able to record those during exposure sessions. And so this is a whole new field, especially in OCD, and so we're just learning what to make of these recordings, but it's been fascinating to be able to actually watch his brain waves change as we're doing these exposures, and to watch his brain waves change over time from when he first had DBS to, you know, 7 months later, what they look like.
Yeah, and you've traveled. Can you talk a little bit about what you've done in the months since?
Yeah, so I think the big trip was I went to Orlando for my cousin's wedding. I have many, many, many cousins, and I love all of them. And so went there, and then my sister and I are huge Disney fans, and we went to Disney World. I've been to Disney World except for 1 year in the pandemic where we skipped, basically every year for the last 4 years. And I never use the restroom at Disney World. I always go back to the hotel and use the restroom and shower and do my rituals. But this time around, I used the restroom at Disney World, kept on going with my day. And yeah, it was really kind of nice to be able to have a little bit more normalcy, you know, be able to just kind of function in a way that is normal. And I think the two points I'd make here is, one, it isn't easy. You know, even using the restroom at Disney World, it wasn't easy. And definitely touching the toilet that Dr. Davis talked about, it is not easy. I do not enjoy it. I don't enjoy the process. I don't enjoy the afterwards. I definitely want to shower and, you know, clean everything. But it's possible. And that's the big thing. And the second point is that just takes a lot of work.
Right. And Moksha, what do you think is the future for this procedure? And what do you want people living with OCD to know as you continue to make progress?
Yeah, so for people with OCD out there, I think I have a few kind of take-home messages. The first is you're not alone. I think oftentimes OCD is a disease of uncertainty, of shame, of guilt. You feel you should be one way and you're not. And so you're constantly living your life trying to change the way you are, but as soon as you think you get there, another obsession sets in and you realize you never get there. And so I would say, even during this process, we've met so many people who are like, oh, I know my, you know, blank has OCD. And so I think the first thing you realize is you're not alone. And the second thing I want to point out there is hope. And I will say this as someone who had literally given up hope. You know, I didn't know, I'm a doctor, I didn't know DBS for OCD was a thing. I had no idea until I met Dr. Davis. And I, like I mentioned, I had met 12 to 13 psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers before Dr. Davis. And so I had no idea. And I had truly given up hope. I thought this was my life and I didn't know what was going to happen. And it was just kind of like live moment for moment and struggle to exist. But I think the message I want to give there is, you don't know what's on the horizon. There are revolutionary treatments. And again, DBS isn't for everyone, as Dr. Davis mentioned, but there are many options, even once patients have potentially failed more conventional treatments. I think the most important thing there is to find a qualified and experienced provider who is experienced in obsessive compulsive disorder. Because there are some amazing psychiatrists who maybe deal with addiction or, you know, PTSD, who may not know the literature and data as well. And so finding someone who really understands OCD and the cutting edge treatments for OCD, and also exposure therapy and how to really run that. And then the last message is one that both Rachel and I talked about, is that we all wish you could wave a magic wand. I tell my patients this all the time. I wish I could wave a magic wand and fix your disease. Unfortunately, modern medicine is not there and probably will never be there. And DBS is not a magic fix. Mm-hmm. You know, it is great. It has been life-changing for me. It really has. But it takes a lot of work. It takes constant effort. And there are good days and bad days. You know, there are days when I feel like, man, I am struggling today. And it is a chronic disease. And it's like any chronic disease, you know, lupus or chronic pain. You know, you're going to have bad days and good days. And so just working constantly and just remembering that, yes, it's a lot of work, but it's worth it. You know, your life is worth it. So that's what I'd say to people with OCD. You're not alone. There's hope. And it's worth the work.
And Moksha, I have a question for you,
actually.
So you're a physician. And you're talking about having a mental illness. You're very courageous. Why are you doing this? What has motivated you to do this?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. So without getting into details, I've definitely dealt with stigma of mental health earlier in my life. You know, people have said, oh, you should be in a loony bin, and, you know, when I'm doing rituals. And I've definitely dealt with the stigma. But for me, I think really it comes down to how do you break stigma? And I think stigma is really based on the unknown. People are fearful or don't understand something, so they form preconceived biases towards it. And I think what is really important, and we often call it mental health, and it is mental health, but it's really brain health. You know, this is a brain disorder. Nothing changed from me pre-surgery to post-surgery except two electrodes, mm-hmm. you know, and some stimulation. And there was no major psychodynamic revelation. I didn't uncover some trauma from my past. You know, I was trying in therapy before, and I was trying in therapy after. But changing the electrochemical circuitry in my brain helped me now respond. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really important to realize that this is a true biological disorder with biological underpinnings, as is any of the disorders I treat, hypertension and diabetes. And so by being open about this, I think my hope is that people realize, hey, let's treat this like a quote-unquote medical disease, and realize that sometimes people say, oh, it's all in your head. You know, well, technically a stroke is also all in your head. You know, that doesn't make it any less real. Mm-hmm. I think just trying to understand that, yes, this is a true biological disease and we need to deal with that. And then the second thing is that you can have these diseases and be a normal-ish, you know, we all have our quirks, but normal-ish person and a functional person. And so I think that's why I'm doing this, is to try to help other people realize that they can be themselves and not be shamed for having this.
Well, I have to say, I admire your courage and your transparency.
CU Anschutz 360 is produced by the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus. Story editing and production by Kelsey Peters. Digital design by Sarah Adams and Jenny Merchant. A huge, huge thank you to our guests this week, Rachel Davis and Moksha Patel, who have both been working with me for over a year to tell this story. You can read Moksha's story, learn about Rachel's research, and more stories and breakthroughs on our campus at news.cuanschutz.edu. This is CU Anschutz 360.